This is AMDA On The Go, your gateway to expert discussions, journal article reviews, and innovation in post-acute and long-term care. AMDA On The Go is a presentation of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this podcast is provided by Afoundria, the makers of ChartPath. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now here's our host for AMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to AMDA On The Go. This podcast will focus on a discussion around suicide prevention in special older adult populations. There are real stories. A gentleman in his 80s, burdened with metastatic cancer and under hospice care at home, tells his wife he is going to take a nap, but instead pulls a gun from his nightstand and shoots himself. Four towns away, another older adult and recent widower, after learning he has stage 4 cancer, comments to his family about euthanasia, manages to get one of his own firearms into a skilled nursing facility, and also shoots himself. Although it is difficult to read or hear about these events, however so seemingly rare among causes of death, suicide and suicide in older adults is very real. According to a Centers for Disease Control, CDC, 2018 report, suicide rates have been rising in every state. Nearly 45,000 Americans died by suicide in 2016. Suicide is the 10th leading cause of death, and suicide is one of the three leading causes of death on the rise. In her 2019 New England Journal of Medicine perspective piece, "When a Patient Dies by Suicide, the Physician's Silent Sorrow," Dr. Dinah Miller, of course, talks about the tremendous spectrum of toll from suicide on families, the considerations of what could I have done, but as the psychiatrist's biggest professional fear and failure and shame. Where do we begin? How do we approach the topic of the risk for suicide, especially in older adults? What words do we use? Are there models we can apply? Can we even get beyond our own trepidations of entering into a conversation to begin with? As I did my own research around suicide prevention in the older adult population, one name, Dr. Elizabeth Conti, was prevalent among behavioral health forums. Whether it be via podcast or video or in reviewing her 2019 clinical geriatrics article, Dr. Conti and her colleagues have a plan, a safety plan, to manage suicide risk. And as luck would have it, we are fortunate to have Dr. Conti with us now. Dr. Elizabeth Conti is a staff psychologist at the Michael E. Dubakey VA Medical Center in Houston, Texas. She specifically works in the institution's cancer center and is a member of the palliative care team. Dr. Conti, welcome to AMDA On The Go.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Conti, I typically like to start our discussions with somewhat of a historical perspective to set our framework. In the 2012 National Strategy for Suicide Prevention, a document which represented an ongoing discussion from its initial publication in 2001, I was surprised to read that the focus of the Surgeon General's preface comments reflected the burdens of suicide on the 45-year-old or younger population. It wasn't until a brief discussion around prevalence that we see the significant inflection point at age 70, demonstrating the increase in suicide among older men to a rate that exceeds 40 per 100,000 population. The 13 goals and 60 objectives in the national strategy are geared to promote wellness, increase protection, reduce risk, and promote effective treatment and recovery. But we're talking now about a different population here, not just older adults, but those perhaps at end of life themselves or with the potential for acute and significant health and social changes, you know, where treatment and recovery may not be a feasible part of the care plan. So many questions to start. How did this area and focus on older adults become a topic of interest for you? How have we come to consider, assess, and evaluate the older adult at risk for suicide? Tell us about the resources, the institution, that the layperson or professionals like me, folks in the trenches, may have never heard about, like MIRIC. Is it such a tough topic for everyone to embrace? Is it gaining traction as behavioral health itself is becoming more recognized, accepted, and sought out as a crucial piece within the continuum of care?
Well, thank you again for choosing to cover this difficult topic. It's something that I'm really passionate about. I'll say I got started really in my very first year of graduate school. My first clinical experience as a young psychologist was in a nursing home. And I had never really thought about working with older adults before, but I instantly fell in love with it. I really felt like this was a population that needed attention, that had a lot of needs, but also a lot to offer, a lot of wisdom and experience. And I've focused since that time very exclusively on the geriatric and people with serious medical illnesses. So I think when we think about older adults at risk for suicide, there's a really nice model that's been recently proposed by my colleague Kim Van Orden and Yates Conwell. And that proposes the five D's of older adult suicide. So I'm going to just throw those out there right up front, because I think they're super helpful for assessing suicide risk in older adults. And the five D's are depression, disability, including pain or difficulties with functioning, disease, including long-term chronic disease or things like cancer, deadly means, firearms, and disconnectedness. So loneliness, feeling like a burden, not feeling connected to the people around them. So I think keeping the five D's in mind and understanding that for folks in long-term care, of course, a lot of these are going to be present. So some resources, of course, it's ideal if you have a mental health professional on your team, whether that's a social worker, psychologist, psychiatrist, maybe a nurse who has some psychiatric experience. I really encourage you to try to get a person like that on your team, because we have therapies specifically designed for this population. Things like, we call them dignity therapy, meaning-centered psychotherapy. So we're not trying to completely ameliorate the feelings of depression or burden, but really focus on how can we get the person to reflect on their own life and the things that are still important to them, that were important to them, and that still matter at the end of life. And reminiscence therapy, supportive therapy, these can all have an important role. One resource that I'll point out is the SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. So this is a federal organization. They put out a guide called Promoting Emotional Health and Preventing Suicide in Senior Living Communities. This is a really wonderful guide because it's actually a training for staff in nursing homes that specifically guides them on how to assess for suicide risk and what to do when they detect it. The MIREC, the South Central MIREC, and the Centers for Excellence in Suicide Prevention are within the VA. They have funded my work in suicide prevention and are some of the leaders in research on suicide in older adults. It's because we have so many older adults in the VA system, and of course, preventing suicide is a top priority, if not the top priority in VA.
Wow.
So I do think that this is a tough topic for people to embrace, but I think when you're working at end of life, comfort talking about death, comfort talking about suicide is going to be really critical so that you can have the honest conversations that you need to have with folks to understand their risk.
Dr. Conte, in 2012, Dr. Barbara Stanley and others wrote an article in Cognitive and Behavioral Practice entitled Safety Planning Intervention, a Brief Intervention to Mitigate Suicide Risk, in which she sought to extend assessing suicide risk beyond the emergency room and into other settings. She wrote, and I'm paraphrasing, if patients are given tools to reduce or decrease suicidal urges, then risk of suicide is likely to decrease. You have extended this idea with your collaborative safety planning for older adults model. Please lead us through the model, most specifically through the six steps of the safety plan. I know that it has been framed around the needs of the veteran, but does it extend to other adult populations as well? Does it require specialty training to administer?
So safety planning is a wonderful tool. There used to be sort of a psychiatric practice that was called a no suicide contract, where if the doctor was worried about the patient, they would have them sign a paper promising that they wouldn't kill themselves before the next session. This turned out to be A, not effective, and B, probably very damaging to rapport. And so what do we do instead is something that sometimes confused with that, but is actually very, very different, which is a safety plan. And so the safety plan is a collaborative plan made collaboratively for what the patient will do when they feel suicidal. So this does require some time with the patient and sitting down and really working with them in kind of a counseling framework, but it doesn't actually require you to be a psychologist. Hmm. And in fact, I wrote a brief manual that you were referencing. And when I wrote that, I really wanted it to be used by non-therapists, by nurses, or by physicians who are interested in doing this process with their patients. So basically, first you talk about warning signs. What are the things that lead the person to start thinking about suicide? Is it increased pain? Is it feeling lonely? When they're thinking about their illness and they're feeling hopeless, is it when they haven't had visitors for 3 days? And so when they can recognize their warning signs, then they know it might be time to use the plan. Other warning signs might be things like thinking about getting out my gun or thinking about ways that I could end my life. And so you try to build awareness around what comes first. Suicidal thoughts might get really intense or they might even attempt suicide. So once you build that awareness, then you talk about what they should do next. And in older adults, it's really key that they reach out for help. Now, they're not going to reach out to just anyone. And probably most people are not comfortable calling any old friend and talking to them about their suicidal thoughts. So you're going to talk about who in your life could you reach out to who A, might distract you, who might make you feel better in that moment, or is there someone that you could actually tell, hey, I'm really struggling, I'm starting to think about suicide. Is there a professional, a doctor, a social worker, a therapist who you feel comfortable reaching out to? Give them the crisis line number as part of that plan. And then also talk about coping strategies that they can use themselves. What are things that make them feel good? And what I might want to highlight is how we address that disconnectedness. Can they write a letter to someone? If they're at home, is there something that they can do to be around other people? Can they go to a park? Can they go to a coffee shop? Can they go to a senior center to decrease that disconnectedness and that distress in the moment? So this is going to be very individualized for each person, which is why it's collaborative. And it's important to pull out the strengths and the resources that the person has and emphasize that even if they have to do things now in a different way, that there are still opportunities for them to gain more support and reduce their distress. Mm-hmm. Now, it does sometimes happen that people will say, I don't have anyone. I don't have anyone to reach out to, or there's nothing I can do. And that's common in people who are depressed. So that may be over the course of 3 meetings, you're building skills, teaching them maybe relaxation strategies or mindfulness, or brainstorming simple things that they are able to do even in their nursing home room, getting them books that they enjoy, music that they enjoy, things like that. And starting with the crisis line and the professional supports, and then perhaps building more social supports or making a plan for building more social supports as you go forward. And I will say, it's difficult to do outcomes research on deaths by suicide because it is a relatively rare event. But Craig Bryan has been the leader in working with military populations. And he does something, he calls it a little bit something different. He calls it a crisis response plan, but it's the same thing. And he has actually found a reduction in suicide attempts for people who he has used this plan with versus usual care, and also faster resolution of the suicidal crises. So people are less suicidal quicker. Mm. Other research has found fewer hospitalizations and increased use of mental health care.
Our interview will continue after this brief message from Afoundria, the creators of ChartPath. Our world is changing, and the demands on your practice are growing. Nobody wants to just buy an EHR. You want a technology partner by your side. That's why they built ChartPath, a simple-to-manage and simple-to-use EHR backed by a dedicated team 24/7 that will guide your practice through MIPS and help you manage your growth. Most importantly, ChartPath is efficient, so you can continue to give your patients the high level of care you are known for and still make it home in time for dinner.
We're having a fascinating discussion with Dr. Elizabeth Conti about suicide prevention in older adults. Dr. Conti, in a very brief reflection within a 2017 Annals of Palliative Medicine article entitled Suicide in the Palliative Care Setting, author Chloe Choi is troubled by the dearth of suicide statistics, and she wonders if the lack of management strategies or professionals' attitudes or judgments towards suicide are the reasons. When it comes to suicide risk in hospice care, there is also a lack of information. The topic quickly morphs into physician-assisted suicide, ethics around suicide and end of life, or even what a practical response to a proposed suicide might be in a hospice patient. For example, calling 911, seeking out the attending physician, or looking to the caregivers or families to manage the issue. You know, we're not talking about such things now as Oregon's Death with Dignity statute, but we are talking about real people and families. Options for cure may be gone, pain may be prevalent, and sadness is the current normative state. Should we consider every hospice patient as a suicide risk? How can we improve quality of care in this population when it comes to behavioral considerations? Does your collaborative planning apply here? What is the most fundamental approach that we can take as a hospice team in reducing suicide risk?
Mm-hmm. I do think professionals' attitudes, meaning ageism, meaning that sometimes suicide of an older person is seen as less tragic or more expected or more understandable than suicide of a young person. I think often if the main focus is, of course, on their medical care, there may be less attention to the psychological and psychiatric care. One thing that my mentor always emphasized is that just because a person is old or just because a person is at end of life doesn't mean that they should be depressed or that we expect them to be depressed. And it's a bit of a stereotype of the old, sad, depressed person. Suicidal ideation is also not a normal, expected part of dying. And if there is suicidal ideation, it usually means that there is more suffering than we would like. This is to be contrasted with something that we call preparatory grief, which is what people go through when they're dying and they're preparing to lose everything. So they're losing every relationship in their life. They're losing their home. They're losing their pets. They're losing themselves. And this is a process that people could go through, and they can be very, very sad. But this can also be a process that's full of meaning as they say goodbye and they make sense of their life and what it has meant. I think when we're talking about hospice patients and suicide, one important concept to think of is the concept of the good death. So most people that I know, that I've talked to, that I can imagine would not think that a violent, sudden, solitary death is a good death. So people aren't choosing suicide because they want suicide. They may be choosing suicide because they feel like they want control, or because they feel like a burden to their family, or because they feel like things are meaningless. And these are things that we can address through therapy and through possibly changes in their environment, in their support team. The other thing that we can absolutely address is their access to firearms. So in the two anecdotes that you mentioned in the beginning, they were both firearm deaths. And especially in older men who have these really high rates of suicide, most of them who die by suicide are by firearms. It's about 70%.
Wow.
So access to firearms alone, if we can reduce access to firearms, we are going to be cutting that person's suicide risk. Because it's actually a myth that if someone wants to die, they'll find any way to do it. That's been disproven. Yeah. And people usually have a method that they prefer, and it's often a firearm. The other thing about firearms is that they're much, much, much more deadly than taking an overdose of medication. So most people who take overdoses survive. Most people who shoot themselves don't. So with the gentleman, you know, with being aware, asking about firearms, I ask veterans about firearms all the time. You can imagine they don't really like that question. But once I make it clear that it's because I care about their life and because I care about their safety, the vast majority of them discuss it with me, honestly. And then what I ask them to do in the outpatient setting is to put some space between themselves and the firearm. So whether that's giving it to a family member to hold for now, or locking it up and giving someone else the key, or even removing ammunition from the house. And those could all be options for someone who is on hospice. Obviously, in a nursing home or a, you know, acute care or long-term care facility, we don't want there to be firearms in that situation. And so, obviously, the staff would want to do everything that they can to keep firearms out of that situation.
Sure. Dr. Conti, as has become customary in the time we have remaining, I wish to be a little provocative with you, but not really. Mm-hmm. You are no stranger to long-term care considerations, and actually you've talked about some references regarding long-term care in this discussion. You have published around burnout and coping strategies among long-term care nursing and assistant staff. In a June 2019 Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, article entitled Suicide Among Older Adults Living in or Transitioning to Residential Long-Term Care, 2003 to 2015, the authors identified 1,037 suicide deaths in older adults living, transitioning to, or associated with long-term care. The number represented 2.2% of their sample suicide population, which I think was around 50,000 individuals. We know that behavioral assessment is based typically off of a patient health questionnaire, especially in facilities, one of the PHQs. It's completed at specific intervals by a facility nursing coordinator. Is 2.2% significant enough to warrant or raise concerns about an older adult behavioral health issue in this setting? If so, how do we advocate for assessment or better assessment? The questions we always ask is, what can we do today to evaluate for suicide risk in the long-term care setting? And should this be a, what we call a quality assessment, performance improvement, or QAPI strategy for all nursing facilities?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think suicide and behavioral health in general is very important to attend to in long-term care. And the PHQ or the PHQ-9, which I use frequently in my clinical practice, is just a starting point. So in the PHQ-9, that last question 9 asks about thoughts about being better off dead or of killing yourself. The question is two-barreled, right? So it asks about thoughts about being better off dead, which we could also call death ideation, and thoughts about killing yourself, suicidal ideation. So if the person endorses that question, there's a lot more digging that we can do. In the VA, we've now implemented a standardized suicide risk protocol, which includes the PHQ-9 as level 1, and then something called the Columbia Suicidal Risk Scale as level 2. And the Columbia is also a really brief scale, but what it asks about is, have you had thoughts about suicide in the last 3 months? Have you actually made a plan for suicide in the last 3 months? Have you prepared to do it? And these are really important questions to get at acute risk, because many people, especially people who have depression, have thoughts about suicide, but no plan and no intent. And some people also think a lot about death, but because of other protective factors like religiosity, or family or children, suicide is not an option for them. So in fact, the PHQ-9 can give us a lot of false positives. And so you'll need to have someone on staff who can have these conversations with the patient about their suicidal ideation, about their intent, about their plan, if they have access to means, because otherwise you're not doing a really complete assessment of their risk, and you're going to have so many people who are endorsing the PHQ-9. I've seen figures up to, you know, 30 or 40% in this kind of population that it's not meaningful then anymore. So then what do you do with that information? How do you intervene? Right. So once you really identify the people who might be at highest risk, then ideally you would really focus on those people for behavioral treatment. And some things that I think in long-term care they could do today is, and I'm getting this also from the SAMHSA manual, so this was written by people who are experts in long-term care, is increasing meaningful activities like reminiscence. So reminiscence therapy is an evidence-based treatment for late-life depression and late-life distress. Volunteering, even very, very small things. I mean, there's been a study, I haven't read it in a long time, it showed that watering a plant, being responsible for a plant in a nursing home, can improve someone's, their mental health, essentially.
Wow.
And so there are relatively brief, small interventions that could be used for targeted residents and targeted folks, in addition to, of course, medication and psychiatric interventions. So in sum, I think if a facility really wanted to address their suicide risk, they would need to go beyond the PHQ-9. But what they can do is focus on the hopefully relatively few, the small number of people who are really at serious risk for suicide. Now, just to complicate things a little bit more, older adults, more so than younger adults, tend to deny thoughts of suicide. So then we do need to look at these other risk factors. And I'll bet that the gentleman that you noted at the top of the podcast probably didn't discuss their thoughts of suicide with other people, which is why it can be important to ask. And asking, the research shows us, doesn't put the idea in the person's head. So again, comfort with that conversation is really important.
We have been privileged to speak with and learn from collaborative safety planning expert, Dr. Elizabeth Conti. Dr. Conti, thank you so much for spending your time with AMDA on the Go.
You're so welcome. It's really been a pleasure.
References for this podcast can be found at paltc.podbean.com. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for this innovation podcast that we call AMDA on the Go.
Support for this podcast is provided by Afoundria, the makers of ChartPath. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM, pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, please email cmd@paltc.org with your name and the podcast's title. Thank you.